Breaking the Gray. Guess, Sarah, to you, because I guess it's still the evening for you and morning for me. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Ross. How are you doing?
Great. Never better. You know, I'm wearing my blue today, I guess. I didn't realize how much I enjoyed the color blue, but today it must be one of those days that I'm committed to my color. So I was telling my daughter when we were traveling the other weekend, I was like, if you just look at people, you can actually see their spirit color or their aura color, and there's pinks and yellows and everything. So mine must be blue. I haven't like researched what the aura of blue is, but I wear a lot of blue.
It's a strong color, Russ. Suits you.
What's your color? I know you wear a lot of red.
Well, I wear a lot of red for my branding, but I wear turquoise a lot. I think turquoise.
We're both blue people. Yeah, we're both blue people. So, Sarah, we have a wonderful guest today, still on our anti-aging longevity track. We're meeting some of the best scientists and specialists in the field. Who do we have today?
Today we have Anders, who's going to talk to us about monitoring tech. Welcome, Anders. It's so nice to meet you. It's very rare that we have someone on that we don't actually know in person. So it's fabulous for you to come on. We're really looking forward to hearing all about your technology, because we're into the self-measurement. We're into quantified self. And really, like Russ said to you before, we're trying to focus on longevity. And we know, you know, unless you measure it, you just don't know. So please feel free to give a little bit of background about yourself so that we can learn it too.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me here. So my name is Anders Mörman. I'm the CEO and co-founder of the Swedish consumer health tech startup Diversify. And personally, I'm a trained physicist. I have a Master of Science in Engineering Physics, and I worked all my life in medical technologies, building products, world-class products, really, for specialized medicine and selling to hospitals and installing and getting them to cure people around the world. I did that since 1992, and primarily in radiation therapy of cancer. So I worked 21 years in that field, and then I got headhunted to become CTO at Aerocrine, which we were building breathalyzers for nitric oxide to detect the degree of inflammatory asthma in your bronchial tree in parts per billion. Very precise instrument. And then I got into a little bit more breathalyzers and biomarkers, particularly non-invasive biomarkers and whatever molecules you could capture in breath, in exhaled breath. Fast forward to 6 years ago, we founded the company. And I've been working here as a CEO, trying to struggle with the startup world since. But nothing I regret. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah, I've been in the startup world many times. It's as a co-founder and it's hard, but the reward is there. I'm sure you can see it, right? You can see the light. It's just mired.
It's a long tunnel. Yeah, but you can see the light.
It's a long tunnel.
Yeah.
And this is something you're selling direct to consumers, or are you working with partners in hospitals and doctors?
No, I got tired of working with partners and hospitals and selling to them. There's a very long, you know, selling cycles and a long validation. And I guess you are as well as me. I'm not a friend of Western medicine in that sense. We're not working too little on prevention. We're working too little on we have this controversial idea that lifestyle diseases are best treated with lifestyle changes, not drugs. I don't know why that's controversial. It's controversial in Sweden, and I'm sure it's in Britain and even in California too. So, we're going to the grassroots movements. We're selling to biohackers, but also to people, particularly on our first product, ACETrack, which measures if you're in ketosis in a non-invasive and very precise way. Selling that a lot to people with mental health problems, with certainly obesity, diabetes type 2, people that really need help and need help to make their lifestyle changes work. I know we're going to talk about longevity. I'm an expert now on premature death, so we can talk about that too. But you know, if you don't die prematurely, I'm sure you will live long. And that's really what our focus is. It's not necessarily on the 100 years old people. I love those people too, but we are trying to save those that actually die before 70. And that doesn't mean anything.
And it's interesting because the differences between Sarah and me in our intrinsic and extrinsic aging scores is the fact that I had not really childhood, but in my 20s, I had cancer. Sarah's been on the track for a while, right? She's been on a healthy track for a while. I'm just getting started. This is like my fourth year working with Sarah, where I'm like actually thinking about taking care of myself and not four children or obsessing over the cancer I had. I wonder when, you know, for your device, we haven't really talked about what are you actually measuring and what are you looking for? And what are the markers you're looking for?
Yeah, so we have this device. I'm showing it in the picture here now. It's called X-Track. It's a breathalyzer in one breath, a controlled breath where you, at the same time as you breathe, you watch your screen on your phone. So make sure that you exhale with the same pressure over 6 seconds and sample from the bottom of your lungs. We detect the level of acetone in your breath in parts per million. And we're really the only breathalyzers on the world market for acetone now, right now, that are measuring in the real unit for physical units of that parts per million. And if that number is high, you have been in ketosis about 10 to 60 minutes ago. So you can really see if you've done the right thing the night before, the morning after. For me personally, if I have a high value, yeah, I know I did everything right. And I've learned over the last couple of years, I can't eat anything after 9 o'clock. Then I'm out. Then all night, my insulin levels and everything will go haywire. But if I've learned by having this device personally that for me, this is very individual. For me, I have to have a long fasting window during night, and then I can be in ketosis in the morning, for example.
Even if you're just eating fat, even if you're just eating fats.
Yeah, absolutely. I can still not eat late in the evening. I need to combine in my case, and I think that goes for many middle-aged people. Most of our customers are middle-aged women, actually, here in Sweden. For them, you know, they've been yo-yo banting all their life, and they are getting all these kind of vague symptoms, anti-immune symptoms, a number of different things, and you don't really think the diet may necessarily have very much to do with it. You may not even be overweight, but it does. And for middle-aged people, it's important to have a long fasting window every day, preferably only like 2 meals per day, and that goes for me too. Although I've been healthy, like you, Sarah, all my life, so I'm not doing it from a personal experience. By saying, yeah, no, but I do not doing it from personal experience. But I do know that I have a much better metabolic flexibility now since I started working with this than I ever have.
Yeah, that's a kind of a key word right now, isn't it? Metabolic flexibility. A lot of, you know, in the biohacking circles, a lot of people are aiming for that rather than maybe just being totally carnivore or totally keto all the time. Having a metabolic flexibility where your body is able to utilize carbs, sometimes is able to utilize fats.
Yeah, we're evolutionary built to, we're the best omnivore on the planet, and we weren't built to have regular meals in the same hour every day, lunch and evening, and we're certainly not built to eat the same things all the time. We had to eat whatever scavengers that we could find.
Whatever's in my pantry is basically where I'm at these days.
No, not whatever's in your pantry, Russ. I know you can't put butter and Doritos in there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm coming from this from the perspective of I'm still just getting started on a lot of these, and especially with keto. And I'm curious with your device, how do you couple that up with like the beginners and getting started? I would love to try the device. I'm not in ketosis. I know that because I know my diet is not very good right now, Sarah. Don't judge. But I'm curious, how do you couple it with kind of the getting started beginners, in ketosis and the keto diet?
Yeah, this is a product that actually turns to both the hardcore biohackers that just want to compare it with blood sampling and measuring blood ketones with a prick your finger and have a ketone strip and all of that. And we sell the products to them too, and eventually they will replace that because it's actually a much better deal and better. You will actually see more things momentously with AceTrack. We can measure like 10 times a day if you want. It's completely non-invasive and inexpensive. Yeah.
And we've talked to several of our guests use your device and have talked about your device and talked about actually using the breath and say it, they prefer it. And I agree. I hate the finger prick. We've had to do several of them, and all my fingers are now pricked, and I'm like, I'm still not getting a drop of blood. That says something else about me, I'm sure. But
to a newbie, I would say it is also a good product because it's gamified, and you can just get started. You will have low values for weeks and weeks, but then suddenly one day you have under 10 parts per million for weeks. Every morning you measure, and then one morning you will have 50. And then you realize, wow, what did I differently yesterday than I didn't do all the other days? Maybe it's just because your insulin resistance has become good. Maybe it's just luck. But if you measure 52 days in a row, two mornings in a row, well, that's really the lifestyle tool that you need to make to get, you know, promoted to get mentally charged with yes, you know, you will get a number. It's like a step counter. Something like our users, you know, want to do 10,000 steps or whatever. This is a positive measure. But of course, you're not going to sell AceTrack and have them understand to the man on the street, if they don't know what keto is, then there is no point of having this device. You need to know a little bit about it, and then you maybe don't want to go to blood sampling, but you want to try. You know, it could be worthwhile to try it.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about the biohacker and quantifying yourself. And Sarah and I have talked about this for several years, and it is the number one thing around. Being, you know, having the agency of taking care of yourself. And I can tell you my example is sleep, where I was a terrible sleeper. We talked to a few guests about the power and importance of sleep, got the Oura Ring. I can tell you pretty much what my score is going to be the minute I wake up and how I feel. I'm like, I think I'm going to be a 70 today because I slept terribly. My dog was up all night throwing up. I think I'm going to have a low score. But I do know how important it is. And I think it's the importance of having the right kind of diet to couple that with health and well-being and getting started. And the gamification is important. I've there's so many apps that I've used that the gamification allowed me to kind of grow, especially with meditation, and some of the meditation apps are really good at that as well. So I'm excited. I'm really excited to use it.
Actually, I met a Finn at the Biohacker Summit in Amsterdam in October, and he really liked, you know, that Oura Ring is Finnish. Anyway, he said that I think AceTrack is the Oura Ring for metabolism, and that was a good nice thing to say. I'm not
sure. Yeah, that's an accolade coming from a Finn too.
Yeah, from a Finn too. So we're trying to be that. And again, metabolism. To be a little bit more serious, a lot of our users believe they are in ketosis while they are in starvation. There's no real, you can't really tell by the feeling. It feels like you have a runner's high, or it feels like it's the same. But your brain, I usually say that our brain is a greedy banker, and it doesn't want to release fat at all, because evolutionarily we're built, and the brain is wired to make itself survive. Eventually, if everything else is lost and there's no food for months and months and months, the brain will have to survive on the last fat you have. So it's not going to release the fat very easily. You might as well, just as well, sacrifice muscle proteins and convert that into glucose. And that's called starvation. But the feeling of being in starvation rather than in ketosis or just fasting, you can't really tell, except that you're oozing acetone, and that's what we measure. So
I'm interested to know, and I know that we maybe begin to talk a little bit about your competitors, but I've got Lumen and Food Marble, which are measuring different things, I believe. So Food Marble is measuring hydrogen.
Hydrogen and methane, actually. So
hydrogen and methane. And then the Lumen's measuring, is it carbon dioxide?
Yeah, it measures carbon dioxide and oxygen as well on exhalation and inhalation and exhalation. You have a special breath technique in the Lumen. So, yeah. So, you want me to answer them? They're the breathalyzers.
I'm just wondering what the comparison is, because I have both of them and I sporadically use them because I don't do a keto diet mainly. I mean, I'm a bit of a carb fanatic, which I try to every now and then. I switch to doing like a more high fat diet, but I actually kind of seem to do fairly well on a reasonably high carb diet. So there's two questions there. One is kind of what is your device measuring compared to some of these other ones? And two, when do you really think people need to start really kind of focusing on being in ketosis?
Let's start with sorting out our, you know, competitors and everything else. We're measuring acetone. There are a few others, the three others on the world market right now, and there used to be another European one. And the first one on the market was Ketonix. It was also a Swedish device. They're not doing really well at this point. And there are two American ones. The best one of those is called Biosense, only sold in the U.S., not in Europe. And Keto is another one. And then there's the South Korean one called KetoScan. And there's a few others, you know, that are not really up with these. And they all measure acetone in one way or another. We do it, we think, most repeatability, with the highest repeatability and highest accuracy. Particularly, we divided the markets. It was one Asian, one American, one European. So that's nice. Lumen measures the what's called this direct fat burning. So a short recap on a human metabolism. So if we can produce energy in our cells in the mitochondria, and that can be done either from glucose or ketone bodies, BHB, or directly from fat. But the last one there can only be done in muscle cells, and particularly in the heart muscle cells. So the general consumption of direct fatty acids from the bloodstream is maybe 10 to 15% of our total metabolism during a day. So it's just a minor part. If you want to really burn fat and use your fat storage capacity to energize brain and muscles, you have to be in ketosis. So Lumen doesn't measure ketosis. And ketosis is a natural biochemical process in the liver cells, where the liver mitochondria can metabolize fatty acids into ketones. And one is the blood ketones, beta hydroxybutyrate, a little bit of biochemistry here, that can feed the brain and the muscle cells without any other extras, without insulin, without albumin. It doesn't need anything. It's the most natural type of energy or fuel that can drive cells, all the cells of the body.
And what was that called? Butyrate, did you say? What was the name?
Beta hydroxybutyrate, but in the field it's called BHB, or just blood ketones. That's the easiest. Mm-hmm. It's the equivalent of blood glucose. And then there's a middle molecule called acetoacetate that falls into the urine, and you can measure it with the urine sticks. Maybe you try that. Not very accurate and not very relevant, I would say. And the last part, the residual, the fumes of this hybrid engine that we're born with, if you're in ketosis, is acetone. Acetone is a free radical gas, falls into the blood. If you ever, you know, smelled on a nail polish remover bottle, it's kind of sticky, and it's so. Yeah. So it will be ventilated out through our lungs. It's not metabolized in anything else. You're not going to get acetone into your body other than being in ketosis. So it's a one-to-one connection. For every fatty acid, an acetone molecule falls out into the bloodstream, and it's ventilated out with a half-life of 30 minutes through the lungs, and that's what we measure in parts per million. That's it. And then finally, food marble. As a matter of fact, we and Food Marble have just recently been selected by one of the biggest medtech companies in the world, Abbott, to be part of a challenge to have non-invasive methods to determine your gut status and your microbiome. So what Food Marble, which is already in the market, our version of that is called Abdomatic. It will be more clinical, and it will be more possible to diagnose, for example, SIBO, if you've ever heard of that. Anyway, what they are doing, or what we are doing, is we're looking into digestive disorders based on primarily a little bit on leaky gut, but primarily based on microbiome that have migrated from the large intestine into the small. And when the when those bacteria, which is really the large one, is in the small, they when they meet glucose, they produce methane and hydrogen.
Right. Why do they migrate?
They migrate. That's a great question. Yeah. Well, so if you're talking about SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, that is people. That's one of the fastest growing diagnoses for particularly women in Sweden right now in terms of gastric disease, and maybe the answer to many of these more general irritable bowel syndrome diagnosis that people carry around. So the SIBO, why they migrate? I don't know. I'm not a doctor, but I do know that over time, over being eating a lot of ultra processed food, fast carbs, and fructose, your small intestines eventually will not be able to pick it all up. So it will start falling into the large intestine. So they are overfed there because they love glucose. So then they, you know, kind of migrate. They get too many there, and they migrate from where the good stuff is coming from. So they kind of migrate into the small intestine. And when they're there, which they're not supposed to be, that produces gas belly. It's really a necessary aspect.
I have a theory that these bacteria and things are kind of moving around because of light, because bacteria and mitochondria release light. And they communicate with light. And I think if you get an area in the body where the mitochondria aren't working, or you have a proliferation of these deleterious bacteria, the bacteria move to a place where there's more light for them. I mean, it's just very interesting how, you know, I'm just interested. That's why I ask why people think it's happening. Because I've just made a product that actually shines near infrared light into the gut for reason. Yes. I think if you can get the infrared light through the gut, you can actually, if maybe you can target the actual bugs themselves. I'm not sure about that, but certainly you can target the mitochondria in the area so that they release more light to make it a place where the good bacteria can live.
Exactly. I like that idea. And I do think this is something growing right now. It's something that is based on what's happening over the last maybe 20 years. So it's something related to our general lifestyle, and diet is not everything. Absolutely not. I mean, just the fact that we live very far from what we did 12,000 years ago. That's for sure. And so light,
especially in Sweden, there's not an abundance of,
gastric disorders are more common in the northern region than southern Europe, at least. And it could be based on the diet, but it could also be based on other factors as well, or a combination thereof. Absolutely.
Yeah, light exposure. Yeah, for sure. And I think even in places like where Russ is in California, I mean, they have a lot of light, but they also have a lot of blue light toxicity, and they have a lot of Wi-Fi, and they have a lot of people just being indoors and not going out in the sun.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very interesting. I'm not an expert on red light, but I do know it's important. Yeah.
Yeah. There's, I'm very curious about, kind of the rigors of ketosis. I find that when I'm in something, I'm pretty good at just staying committed and doing it. But I feel like the rigor of ketosis is a little bit harder than other diets. And we've talked a little bit about this, but it is a change of lifestyle. It's a change of sort of everything, in how you consume. And now I think stores have been optimized. More food is available that is kind of in line. But I wonder if there are things that you've done in your life to really help make it less rigorous and make it a little bit easier and more of a seamless thing. Cause it is easy to go and, as Sarah will say, grab some crisps. I mean, it's very easy to go into my pantry and just grab a bag of chips cause there's nothing else in there. Or I am a sucker for those pretzel, with peanut butter inside. Like those, I'm terrible. I eat a whole bag of those in 10 minutes. So, I don't know. Are there tricks to kind of keeping the progress going?
Yeah, and it kind of ties to this other question Sarah had. So yeah, this is my favorite question. I do think that in general, I would say that we have decided not to have keto in our product name. because the word keto has unfortunately been kind of destroyed worldwide. I would say keto comes from ketosis, which is a natural process of the liver, cells in mitochondria there. This is a completely evolutionary natural thing to have for an omnivore. But keto has been, equaled with carnivore. And keto, initially, the ketogenic diet comes from what we give epileptic children, which is strictly 80% fat, 20% protein, no carbs. And that's an extreme diet. Any extreme diet is something you should be careful of. And I'm not pro any of that. What I've learned and what our customers around the world, we're selling HGS really around the world right now, what they are witnessing are that light ketosis is probably the best for you. And going in and out, and metabolic flexibility. Do your cheating, but you'll try to get back. And coming back to myself, living this life, not starting it, and not coming into this. I'm coming in it as a physicist, an entrepreneur, not for a particular need. But I feel I've come to this point where I'm never actually insulin hungry anymore. I'm actually not ever hungry, even if I don't eat for 24 hours. I'm not hungry like I used to be, because I never have high insulin levels. Not even when I cheat. When I eat crisps and I eat pizza, etc., maybe once every 14 days or so, and then those glucose molecules that comes into my body, the cells just devours them, and I consume them right away, and then I'm back. I can cheat on the Saturday. I'm back on Monday. That's fine. But to reach that state, you have to be consequent for a while and not be extreme, but consequent. And my advice, and if you want to live a long life, is to start skipping one meal and take out gluten. And of course, added sugar and sweeteners.
Which meal, Anders?
Yeah, that's very individual. I'm a night person. I never really liked eating breakfast, and my co-founder and wife, Åsa, is the same. But in general, men has easier to skip breakfast than women, but it's very individual. And so I've eaten my last breakfast. That's what I said. I ate my last breakfast 2 years ago. Even if I'm at a hotel where it's free and everything and I slept, I'm not really hungry on anything before 12, anytime.
Have you done the studies, Anders? Have you done the studies using your device to see whether skipping breakfast or skipping dinner has a different effect?
I don't think it has. It's the length of the fasting window. So to me, I've ended up being at maybe 18:6. My perfect day is to eat two meals, one at 1 o'clock and one at 7 o'clock. That's it. And then in the morning, I have to say, I drink coffee with cream and coconut oil. That's what I eat. But I drink coffee with that. That's just to give me a little, and that also comes from the device that we have, because I've learned that you need to kind of prime the pump a little bit. Some dietary fat will also get you into the own fat kind of ketosis. While if you don't prime the pump in the mornings, I tend to not, burn as much, and then I become hungrier. So, yeah.
And that goes in line with what you said about yourself, which is you need that fasting time if you eat too late. So you probably need a good 12 hours or maybe even longer, 18 hours to fast to then get yourself cleared. I felt when I was intermittent fasting, I felt that's when I felt the best, and I really have not reincorporated breakfast in. I have a sugar problem, and my problem with sugar is that once I start eating it, I have a really hard time kicking it. And I started incorporating ice cream. Now I hate ice cream. I am lactose intolerant, but yet I'm eating ice cream. I'm eating dairy-free ice cream. So I have to kick sugar, and I think that that's step one. But kicking sugar takes me about a week. And once I'm a week in, I can look at sugar and be like, I don't need you. We're good. But I'm wondering if are there other culprits. I imagine like alcohol is probably a tough thing to manage. I mean, how do you manage alcohol with your device as well? Does it like spike you or not spike you?
My second favorite question is that, so first of all, some facts. We are the best animal on the planet to also metabolize alcohol. And that is for, you know, for a reason. We have built it into our evolutionary, you know, evolution. Probably because when we, again, were 12,000 years, 50,000 years back, we probably had to ferment things to survive. We've populated the entire planet, as you know, but most of us have been populating in the temperate zone, and there we have winters. So we have to survive winters, but we're not bears and can sleep all through winter. We're going to have energy, and we're very good at building fat during the fall when the fruit and berry season, so we can easily put on weight, fat, so that we can use it during the winter, but also to ferment and we're smart. We're the smartest animal too, so we're smart and we learned how to preserve food simply, and that typically means that alcohol is produced at some point. So we are built to metabolize alcohol. We're actually better to metabolize alcohol. We metabolize ethanol better than fructose. So we're even better at that. And I typically, to finalize this thing, if you don't have an alcoholic problem, as a middle-aged person, man or woman, it's much better to drink a glass of red wine or dry white than a glass of Coca-Cola. It's much, much more dangerous to drink the sugar. I'm sorry to say that, Russ. But the sugar, every fructose molecule you put in has to be converted by the liver into glucose. While alcohol is also produced into glucose, but we metabolize alcohol better than we do sugar.
I wonder, Anders, if you could just briefly just go over the chemistry there, because you kind of mentioned a few things like, you know, insulin and how that relates to hunger and how that relates to breaking down all these sugars. Maybe you could just talk us through exactly how that works, because I'm sure everyone's had the experience of, you know, being starving hungry after eating toast for breakfast or something. But how does that actually work?
Yeah, I'm talking about satiety, because that's what many of the ones talking about. How do you maintain satiety over time?
Yeah, how do you have that full up feeling? Because I mean, I eat carbs and I seem quite happy on it, but I certainly don't have the full up feeling all the time. You know, by lunchtime, I'm ready for my lunch.
So let's start with glucose. When you eat something with glucose in it, with fast carbs, it will immediately be sucked up by your small intestine and go into the bloodstream. It will raise your blood sugar level. And as soon as the blood sugar level goes up above like 6 millimoles per liter, it's preferably around 4.2, as you know. That's the best level. As soon as it goes up high, the brain will tell the body to release insulin, because insulin is needed to it needs an insulin molecule to open the door to the cell to let the glucose in. The problem is, if you live a life of ultra-processed food, high carbs and high sugar, eventually the insulin is like a door-to-door salesman selling vacuum cleaners, and it comes knocking on the door and saying, "You want a vacuum cleaner? Yeah, put it in." Yeah, but then eventually the cell becomes energy poisoned. It's overloaded with glucose inside and glucogen and maybe even blood ketones. They have all of the different vacuum cleaners inside. I don't know if the analogy on the vacuum cleaner is great, but after a while, so the blood sugar level goes up because the cells are not taking in the glucose. So then what the brain does, because eventually if you have high blood glucose level, that will make you blind, you will lose a limb, you will die. So the brain will say, this is unsustainable, let's release more insulin from the pancreas. So there is more door-to-door salesman. Eventually you become insulin resistant. They shut the door permanently. So you will have permanently high blood glucose levels. Even if you don't eat that much carb, but because there, you know that you got your cells tired of knocking on insulin, so you drift towards diabetes type 2, and diabetes type 2, you start to get drugs to lower it, and eventually you will start to inject insulin to get even more in, even though you have a healthy pancreas. So that's the sad story of glucose. Fructose quickly is we're not built to, you know, do anything with glucose. Every fructose molecule and a white sugar molecule consists of one glucose and one fructose. And fructose has to be broken down, especially in the U.S. where you have high fructose corn syrup and all of that. All of them needs to be treated just like an ethanol molecule. So they're just not they're just as bad as alcohol, except they're not addictive. Or maybe they are. We don't know. Let's not talk about sugar addiction. But and then fats eventually, I mean, there's also one great myth is all the fat we have on our body is built from glucose. Three glucose molecule is built into triglycerides. Fat you eat from plants or animals is not. It has to be processed and has to be used as energy. It's a myth that fat is going into our own fat. We build our own fat, of course. So yes, you know that. So fats doesn't need anything. It just needs you to get into ketosis once in a while, and that you do naturally, and if you don't have too high insulin levels.
So when you eat a high fat diet, you know, a higher fat, lower carb diet, you're not getting the insulin. And it's actually the insulin that's triggering the feeling of being hungry.
Yeah, it's insulin. It's not directly the insulin, it's two other insulins, but the insulin is the culprit for that, because insulin is used for fat storage also. And so it's really, insulin is the culprit here. And if you, as long as you have high blood sugar values and thus high insulin values, you can never be in ketosis. It's mutually exclusive. So you have to get calm in your body. You have to empty your, I mean, when you're starting this, we typically recommend that you have a 5 days kind of fasting or low calorie diet, which we have one that we're selling here in Sweden as a course. For 5 days, you get taught how to live on 750 calories per day. And it's actually a vegan course. It's not very much fat in it either. It's just a lot of food, but low calories. And that's the starting point. You need to do that and to burn out your glucagon storage and everything else. And from that point, when you start eating again after 5 days more normally, you could increase. I wouldn't go haywire on too much fat either, because typically your digestive system needs to be adjusted to it too. So I would just reduce the carbs from maybe being 50% of your total energy to 25. Put it that way. And then you replace that equally with protein fat. That's what I would do if I get started. But then don't enemy get stuck on how, again, it should be the same every day. It shouldn't. It's not dangerous to be hungry, and try to challenge your hunger. We're built for fasting, really. So don't worry. And eventually you're not going to die. Your body will tell you to eat something if it's really urgent, and it will solve itself. Yeah,
we've talked to a lot of people who have fasted for, we just talked to someone last week who fasted for 8 days in a dark cave and was fine. Yeah. Fasting is I feel like fasting is actually needed and important. I find that I do it every Monday, and it seems to really help me sort of reset even after a long weekend. I don't drink alcohol, which is great. I've heard it loud and clear about brain health from Sarah and others. I like my brain, and Sarah and I both turned 50 this year, and I think that's why we're so focused on longevity and anti-aging. I'm wondering if this is, as we get older, is this something we need to continue to do? Do we have to alter it as we get older? I think things like bone density, muscle, testosterone, things that we hear about, are there things that we have to keep in mind or add to our diet or even supplements if we're getting into ketosis? Are there things that we should be adding as we get older? Because maybe we're missing a few vitamins here or there, or we're missing some of the supplements we need.
Yeah, we're very individual, but there are certain things that I would recommend differently for men and women that are middle-aged. But the first thing I would like to add is, of course, exercise. And exercise has nothing, for a middle-aged person, has nothing to do with your fat burning. I have to say that right out. There's no proof, and it's just a myth that we should be bashing ourselves for not doing it. Exercise you should do for your brain health. You need that to release all those different hormones that you come after you make a good exercise, and for your mechanical body, of course. That's important. And as a matter of fact, if you exercise too much, it will just drive your hunger. That it does that for me too. So when I've lost most weight, I've just kept eating 2 meals per day or 1 meal per day and not exercising too much, as a side note. So exercise is my first thing.
It's the cortisol,
particularly middle-aged women should do should do workout, train muscles, arms, chest, back, legs. But you know, weights. That's just too rare among middle-aged women. So that's that, and that will you know, feed the right type of hormones. And then on top of that, absolutely supplements. So you go and get your blood tests. An extensive blood test, maybe once a year, maybe twice a year, to see where you're at on your minerals. It goes both for men and women. And you can test your testosterone levels, etc. But if you start eating better and exercise a little bit more, most men naturally will solve the testosterone levels. That's my experience. Again, lifestyle diseases are best treated with lifestyle changes, and then but supplements, absolutely. I would say supplements are needed, and then. You know, sunlight, go out and expose yourself to that. Do the little red light therapy. And, you know, all those biohacking things are, you know, most of them are really good. Doing cold swims and all of those things were built for that.
We're getting to the end now, but I just want to ask you as an aside, as you're a physicist, have you started to look, because a lot of what you've said is biochemistry. It's biology, most of what you've said today and how you're measuring things. But if you're kind of looking at it from a physics angle, you know, things are slightly different, you know, like how the mitochondria works, you know, how cold actually compresses the mitochondria and how light can be emitted from a mitochondria. These are all things which is physics, you know. I mean, they call it biophysics now, but it's really integrating physics in biology. So have you been able to kind of take all of your learning from physics and kind of put it into what you're doing? Do you look at it from that angle, or have you kind of switched to look at it more from a biochemistry angle?
I worked 21 years in cancer care. Diet wasn't mentioned once. This was between 92 and 2013. I think I'm saving more lives on cancer already now by telling people about diet rather than what I did then, to be honest. I'm sure. I mean, it's looking at a solid tumor and the hypoxic part of it in the middle, and which is driven by glucose, etc. But to answer your question, yes, when I approached this, I had to, because I had to understand how do I measure acetone, first of all, in parts per million. So it was a physics approach. And where does the acetone come from? So I kind of looked at it at a mechanistic kind of view. And then there was so much myths about food and human metabolism. What everything I've said here, I would say it's based on first principle physics and first principle chemistry. It's based on what actually happens. It's based on what our human cells does, or animal cells. They do it too, although not everyone is omnivore. But humans are omnivore. I kind of get tired of how the doctors look at it. I mean, a medical doctor in Swedish med school, they have 12 hours of nutrition science. 12 hours in 5.5 years.
I think it's the same for doctors the world over, that they don't have training in all this lifestyle.
And the dietitians, the old one, the dietitians, you know, following the American and nutritional recommendations. I mean, you know, they're the worst, I would say, many times. And not at all based. And I said that in the previous podcast, but most nutritional scientific papers, observational studies, up until 10 years ago, were rubbish, because they were just, you know, nonsense. If you look at pharmacological scientific papers or physics paper, not even mentioned. It's just, but nutrition science has become better. So I have a positive view of it right now, but beware that anyone can, Barilla Institute can come up with a paper saying that pasta is the best thing that has ever been made. So,
well, I think really it's only recently we've had technology like yours. I think that's the difference. You know, one of those nutritionists who were doing their stuff 10 years ago, you know, they were either doing animal studies, which isn't really relevant to humans, or they were testing with blood, which gives you a result which is possibly delayed and has implications. So I think really the advent of technology like you're developing is going to help the whole science move forward in a way where you can actually get a very accurate measurement just from doing something non-invasive, and you can do it on a large scale.
So it's a combination of the what actually happens in the acid citric acid cycle, really looking at how ATP is constructed. I've looked at that. I looked at it's chemistry, really. It's biochemistry, but it's chemistry at its core. This is what's going on over and over and again. So I'm not trying to be so opinionated about it, and then add common sense to that. So if you are a diabetic and you don't have insulin, it's probably better not to eat glucose. But that's not the recommendation for a diabetic type 1. They still eat glucose, and then they inject to give all the money to Novo Nordisk to produce insulin. I don't know. I'm not going to be conspiratorial here, but it's not common sense. If you don't have insulin, and insulin is needed to get the blood glucose out of the blood stream, don't eat glucose.
Don't eat the sugar. Yeah, don't eat the sugar. Yeah, I mean, yes, I think you're right. It's common sense, but it's good to have your technology so that people can actually see it for themselves. Because I think that's the difference. You know, like you say, you're kind of guessing. Oh, with people think, oh, I don't know, one more chocolate bar, that's not going to make any difference. But if you can actually see the result and track it, you know, that's really what helps motivate people and really take responsibility for their own health, which is what we're trying to promote on this podcast, really, is you are responsible for your health.
Yeah, and get a continuous glucose meter and try it for 2 weeks just to see how your blood sugar levels is. Yeah, yes. Do the things like that, then you don't have to do it. The same as you said with something you said earlier, Russ. But anyway, if you have had ACEtrack for a year or so, maybe you don't really need to measure every day any longer because you've learned. And then you start, you know, kind of feel it. And when you're in your sheet month or whenever you sheet, I don't use it either. I don't want to look at it. Just like when you're sheeting, you don't use your bathroom scale either. I mean, you come back to it when you're in the process. So it's a tool. You don't need to use a hammer every day either.
No, there is something that I was talking to a friend the other day, and my relationship with food is I have a psychological problem with food. I have a really terrible, toxic relationship with food. I use food as an exit for stress. I use it as something that, the thing about food that's different than other things, is that it disappears. It's gone. You've done it. You've eaten it. It doesn't exist anymore. So to Sarah's point about eating the extra candy bar, you don't actually know the impact of that. And sometimes I have such a, I don't know if it's a competitive nature in me. I was the oldest of another sister. Like I didn't fight for food as a child. I wasn't the youngest, but for some reason I am competitive with my food. I eat all the leftovers. I don't know. I have a terrible relationship with food. And I think maybe it all starts there of like, how do we redefine our relationship with food so that we respect it and it will respect us. And maybe there's something we need to do here. Now I'm going to go down a vegan train. I'm not trying to do that, but there's something about, having a better relationship with what we put into our bodies, and knowing that it's doing something good for us versus always doing something bad. I don't know. I have a terrible relationship with food, and I have to sort of kick the habit and dump my toxic relationship.
And you're not alone. I mean, many have. I would say it's also a kind of a motivational problem even before you go there. And many people get motivated because they have some kind of symptom that actually will reduce. People realize. I think that the COVID pandemic really got people thinking about, they've learned new words like excess mortality and lifestyle risk factors, and people realize that, wow, how long I live is not just down to my doctor and my DNA. It is too, but it's, you have a lot to do in that change. And then I don't know, Russ, you have to kind of get to the mental, you have to be enough motivated. And right now, when you eat that extra ice cream jar, you're not motivated other than that you have this podcast and this year of longevity thinking, but it's not going to help you in that moment, because it's just too vague, I would say. And that's very, very common. I feel the same. It's just, I can cheat today and I can, you know, do this tomorrow instead.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Anders, where can we find your device? I see a couple of websites. I know that there's Diversify. Should we go to AceTrack? Is that the name of the product?
Get AceTrack. The name of the product is AceTrack, like racetrack without an R. But that was taken. AceTrack.com was taken when we started this 5 years ago. So getacetrack.com. And you will have the exact link buying it from an English speaking area or German or whatever you are in the show notes. And then you will also have a discount code of 20% for your listeners. I don't know if we decided
it's
on what
Rebel Scientist 20.
The Rebel Scientist 20. Yeah, that's what we decided on. So that will be also in the show notes. And we're drop shipping all over the world. As a matter of fact, that was part of Ivor Cummins' podcast maybe 2 months ago now. And that really kicked off sales all over the English-speaking world. So we sold a lot to New Zealand, Australia, thank you, Canada, US, a lot of things in Austin, Texas. I think that seems to be
MedTech hub.
Yeah, I've never been to Austin. So.
It's a biohacking hub there. Just all the biohackers from LA have moved there, and it's super cool.
Not more so, yeah. And then in Ireland and in Scotland, yeah. Places all over the world. And then, of course, our own initiatives where we are selling actively as the Swedish companies in Scandinavia and the German-speaking countries right now, and opening up Portugal and Spain as well. But to your listeners, go to show notes, find the link, and try to start with your lifestyle changes now, and this will help you.
Yeah. Start measuring so that you know what's going on and you have a baseline and you have somewhere to go with it. You know, I think that's...
And it's compatible with all kind of phones, Android, iOS. You just download the app, you register an account, and you start with your exhalation in seconds. So that's the first measurement. My recommendation to anyone who gets one, start by measuring 3 times a day, right in the morning when you wake up, before you brush your teeth, before you drink your coffee or whatever, and then before you go to bed, before you brush your teeth, because any mouth gases will affect the results. So it's better that you haven't had anything in your mouth, no chewing gum or as we haven't seen, snuff or anything else like that for at least 15 minutes before you make a measurement. And then maybe once during the day, then before the meal, before lunch or before dinner, that could be worthwhile. And then you do that the same every day for a week, and then after a week you will start to be able to draw some conclusions.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much for coming on. That was a real informative podcast.
Thank you.
We covered a lot of ground there. Yeah, so thank you very much. And yes, we'll give it a try and see if we can increase our metabolic flexibility for longevity. I'm sure that's the way to go.
Yeah. Thank you. Great conversation.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Anders. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to the Rebel Scientist podcast. If you know someone who would benefit from the topics in this episode, share it with them. Feel free to DM us on all social media channels or email us at sarah@rebelscientist.com. We read and reply to all messages. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel. And if you're listening on a channel that allows reviews such as iTunes, please leave us a fantastic review. We value your support. It all helps. All opinions of our guests are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect their views of Sarah Turner or Russ Eisenman. This is not medical advice. If you have a health problem, please seek a medical professional. The Rebel Scientist podcast is a Breaking the Gray production, hosted by Sarah Turner and Russ Eisenman. Audio production by Dave Visaya and the podcast engineers. For more information and for our biohacking shopping guide, visit rebelscientist.com. To hear more incredible Breaking the Gray production podcasts, visit breakingthegray.com. That's gray with an E, breakingthegray.com.